All right, the kiddos can be dismissed to Kingdom Kids. Those of you who know me know that I am a bit of a traditionalist. I know that I could come to church and preach in a t-shirt and blue jeans if I wanted to, and there have probably been times when I have, but I am still liking the tradition of a preacher wearing a tie and a suit on occasion. I love our worship songs here. I mean, I thought it was great this morning, good every week. I like the contemporary music. I listen to it in my car throughout the week and other places. But truth be told, I love still the hymns of old. And we play them sometimes just during the prelude time. And every once in a while, I'll send a little note to the worship team and say, can we at least sing one hymn this year? And I have a smartphone. And it's helped me be productive, and it provides some entertainment on occasion, but I rather kind of miss the days before smartphones, and when I found a little more relaxation, and life seemed to be a little bit simpler. I miss the respect that children used to show to adults, and the care that the younger generation used to show for the older generation. I'm a traditionalist. But as much as some things just change and are inevitably going to change, there are some things that are never going to change. And for the next 4 or 5 weeks, I want to talk about those things. There are some ancient truths that have stood the test of time that are true today and will be true long beyond our days for all time. And really, the only choice before us is this. How are we going to spend our lives in light of these unchanging truths? Are we going to participate with others who are trying to tear them down? Or are we going to spend our lives enjoying the security and the safety and the beauty that those never-changing truths allow us to have? And I'll just warn you right up front, these five messages are intended to be not politically correct. They may not be very popular among people who would prefer that we find a way to tear these truths down rather than celebrate them. So to set the stage, I guess, for the whole series, I want to start with one of the most controversial verses in the entire Bible. Perhaps one of the most hotly debated verses in the Bible. Ready for this? Brace yourself. It won't even be the whole verse. It'll just be the first four words of the verse. It goes like this. In the beginning, God. Seriously, like, have you ever thought about the ramifications of those four words of the Bible? Like, what if those words are actually true? And I believe they are. One of the most famous scientists of all times, Albert Einstein, said this, "Nothing happens until something moves." Well, as you look around today, something's happened. There's a whole lot of something instead of a lot of nothing. And so Einstein is begging the question, who or what has moved? How did we get here? How did we get all this stuff that's just all around us? How did all of it happen? Well, the fifth word of the Bible answers that question. In the beginning, God created. In the beginning, God moved. What that means is this. In the beginning, God is the foundation for everything in life that you and I hold dear. I'll give you some example of some things. Truth, beauty, goodness. Those things are founded on and rest on those four words. In the beginning, God. You and I, we have a tendency to think of these three things, truth and beauty and goodness, and just don't even really think about what they really mean. Like we kind of think they don't even need explanation. They just exist. And we can all just agree they exist. But the reality is, if you really think deeply about them, there's a lot to learn from this explanation. There's a lot at stake with just those three things. Let's talk about truth, for example. Some of you might really love math. We need people who love math. There are people who see the world through the beauty and the elegance and the structure that math provides. Some of you are really probably pretty proficient at it. But all of us should ask this question. Why is it that 2 + 2 always equals 4? Why is it that 2 + 2 can't equal 5? I'll never forget being in high school. I had to take these required state standardized tests. They still have them today. They were a little different back when I was in school, but I really didn't enjoy them. They took a lot of time. They added a whole lot of stress. They were emphasized a lot more when I was in school than they are now, and we spent a lot of time preparing. Teachers took a great deal of pride in their students excelling at these tests, and they wanted us all to do well. And there were 4 grades you could get on the test. They ranged from really, really good to really, really bad. And so they coached us a lot on getting ready for these tests. And the coaching that we received is still kind of up here somewhere. I think about it from time to time. Teachers would say things like, it's not about getting... Well, I'm sorry, when it comes to the writing portion, the essay portion of these tests, which we had to do long essays, they would say, it's not about getting the right or wrong answer. It's simply about arguing and writing well for whatever it is you're trying to say. And I'll never forget the one specific example our teacher gave us. They said, you can argue if you want that 2 + 2 = 5, as long as you argue well. And if you argue well, you'll get the highest grade. In other words, truth wasn't important. It was just how well you argued for the lie. Whenever you see a denial of truth, I want you to get this. Whenever you see a denial of truth, you're witnessing a denial of God. Intentional or not. And I think a lot of time it's unintentional, but I know many times it's intentional. Like, truth doesn't just hang up here in thin air. I don't get to say, your truth is your truth, and my truth is my truth. Because there actually is a truth. There is the truth. And truth rests on something. It doesn't just hang out there somewhere. It's not relative, as many in our world would say it is. R.C. Sproul was a great theologian and preacher, and he said this. He said it so well. He said, I do not want to drive across a bridge designed by an engineer who believed the numbers in structural test models are relative truths. I want someone who believes in absolute truths to build that bridge. Don't you? A child memorizing the times tables is actually learning something about the one true God. He's learning something about how the world was created by God and how God wanted the world to be. But it doesn't just stop at math. It also involves the realm of science. Science is an awesome tool at our disposal. It helps us observe and understand and analyze the physical realm. We can study oceans and animals and trees and things as breathtaking as galaxies and stars and suns and moons and planets. Maybe nothing so breathtaking as ourselves. Our minds and our bodies and the complexities and intricacies of them. And all of the implications of the detail we've been created with. Which means when you start to understand down at a molecular level what chromosomes mean. Like the distinction between a person made in the image of God who has 2 X chromosomes and the person made in the image of God who has an X and a Y chromosome. And then all of a sudden you can predict what will happen when you put a man in the pool to compete against a woman on a swim team. Because as it turns out, you can deny reality all that you want, but you can't change it. See, whenever you encounter the denial of simple scientific realities, what you're witnessing is an assault on the Creator who designed those realities with intent. Here's another thing it means. It's something near and dear to my heart. It's language. Language and words are really cool. They hold things together. Like, what I'm speaking right now is almost a supernatural thing because words convey meaning. They convey truth. Words can be unbelievably important. George Orwell said it this way. There's no swifter route to the corruption of thought than through the corruption of language. If you were to read 1984 or any of Orwell's other books, you know that he wrote a lot about this extensively. He said this, and I thought it was really profound. Political chaos is connected with the decay of language. Let that sink in a second. Political chaos is connected with the decay of language. Would anyone ever in here even deny that we're living in a time of political chaos? And Orwell would say, yeah, it's directly attributed to the way we use our words. And I think maybe he's onto something. Like, have you ever been in a conversation with somebody and maybe having a disagreement or argument with someone, and you thought you were using the same definitions for a certain word? But over the course of the conversation, you realize, I'm using this word, and I think it means this. But they're over here, and they're using this word. They think it means something entirely different. And it's causing this confusion. It happens all the time. Like, if I were to call 10 of you up here in front and say, hey, I'm going to give you this word, whatever the word is, and I'm going to send you to 10 separate locations, and I each want you to write down the definition of that word, and then bring you all back, you know how many definitions we'd have? Probably about 10, right? Pick your word. Fairness, equality, inclusion. You could pick it, but we'd have tons of different definitions at the end of that simple exercise. But as it turns out, each of those words has an actual definition. It's the only way language can work efficiently. See, when the language and the meaning of words is no longer relied on, what happens to the conversation? Just grinds to a halt. And you're left with two alternatives. You can fight, or you can retreat to the comfort of your tribes. Words and meaning matter. What is the meaning of is, right? So anytime you see an assault on the meaning of words, you're seeing an assault on language. And when you see that, you're seeing an assault on the true God who created the world to have meaning. It's not a small thing. It's not a small thing that Jesus is described to us in the Bible as the Word. His friend John kind of gave his own commentary of Genesis 1:1 when he began his gospel with these words. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And so we're talking about Jesus, and here's what Jesus, as the Word, does. Look at this from Colossians chapter 1. For through him, God created everything in the heavenly realms and on earth. He made things we can see and things we can't see, such as thrones and kingdoms and rulers and authorities in the unseen world. Everything was created through him and for him. He existed before anything else, and here we go, and he holds all creation together. He holds it all together. So if you love math, or you treasure science, or you value language, you should be grateful that you live in a world that is saturated with truth. But that's not all. We live in a world that has something else that's really great. We live in a world that's saturated by beauty. I mean, don't we? Have you ever thought about it? Like when you look around, isn't it almost wrong to try to reduce the beauty of a sunrise or sunset down to some scientific proposition about the Earth's rotation at a certain time of the day? I mean, it's just beauty that we're to enjoy and appreciate. See, nature is saturated with beauty. I've been fortunate or blessed enough to get to the ocean on a few different occasions, and I love to watch the sunsets and the sunrises. I've literally gotten up from a meal in a restaurant and left to go out and see the sunset. I've gotten up early when everyone else is still sleeping so I can get out and to see the sunrise. And I've tried to take pictures of them. Every time I do it, I take pictures, but they never come close to showing what I'm experiencing in the moment. Those moments teach an objective reality, and the objective reality is this. This world is full of beauty, and it didn't have to be. Have you ever wondered about that? Why is Earth the way it is? why isn't Earth like Neptune or the moon? The Creator could have made us able to live in those types of environments. Instead, he decided to pile all of the beauty of the universe into this one planet that we live on. Why'd he do that? Proverbs 30 says it this way. There are three things that amaze me. No, four. Four things that I don't understand. How an eagle glides through the sky. How a snake slithers on a rock. How a ship navigates the ocean. How a man loves a woman. Here's my question. Do you think the guy who wrote that was dumb? I mean, do you think he was just sitting around going, man, I wish I could understand how an eagle's wings achieve lift and the aerodynamics of this? Or I wish I could understand like the skeletal structure of a snake and how it enables its movement patterns. Or how is it the ships bob across the ocean? What's going on in the brain chemistry when a man falls in love with a woman? I don't think that's what he was doing here. I don't think he was dumb. By the way, his name was Solomon. I don't think he's talking about, I think he's talking about things that are far too beautiful to be boiled down as mere facts of the matter. So here's a question for you. Is there a difference between me doing this and this? That's a lot quieter, right? For the sake of the matter, I'll tell you there's a really good pattern there going on. It's pretty kind of cool. Another question. Here's two pictures. Is there a difference between these two? The one on the right is Rembrandt's painting of the prodigal son. I guess you could call, the point is you could call both those two things on the drums music, even though you couldn't hear one. You could call both of those things art, but could you call them all beautiful? One more question. How much would you pay for this picture? Recently, someone paid $1.7 million for it. It begs the question, if it wasn't painted to describe the person, who would pay money for it? As it turns out, art and music and they all rest on this thing we call beauty. It rests on the foundation of, in the beginning, God. The God who is the author of Ecclesiastes 3:11, where it says he has made everything beautiful in its time. He's also set eternity in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. It was G.K. Chesterton who said, every true artist does feel consciously or unconsciously that he is touching transcendental truth, that his images are shadows of things seen through the veil. In other words, when you paint something beautiful, when you compose a beautiful piece of music, you are reflecting the beauty of your Creator, whether you realize you're doing it or not. That's what he was saying in that passage. What about the beauty of family? Unfortunately, it's God's enemies who understand the significance of God's family more than God's family does. See, whether you're talking about Satan's first attack on the first family, or the French Revolution, or the sexual revolution, or whatever it is, there has been a war waged against the family for a very long time. Karl Marx articulated the reasons behind the attack on family. He said, the key to the destruction of the holy family is the destruction of the earthly family. He knew that the way to set his sights on the God that he hated so much was to take out what God loved so much. And that means whenever you see a person or a group or an organization or a movement set as one of their goals, implicit or explicit, the tearing down of the earthly family, you're witnessing a hatred of God being expressed. That's what they're doing. And we're seeing that battle being waged in a political battle today, and we have to stand up for the truth of God's word. They're trying to attack you, and they're trying to attack Christ's church, and they're trying to attack God himself by attacking our families. See, the earthly family and the church family are reflections of the way God intended for human relations to work. And the context for those relationships is not only love, but it's beauty, it's sacrifice. It's meant to be a reflection of God's beauty and ultimately his sacrifice. It doesn't stop with beauty. It doesn't stop with truth. There's something else we take for granted, and it's goodness. Atop of goodness are all kinds of things that we care about, things like compassion, justice, and morality. Question. The very idea of human dignity, where did that come from? Who am I to say what's right and what's wrong? Who are you to say what's right and what's wrong? What you can do and what I can do? Like, who am I to place judgment on a culture like Uganda, where they're now oppressing Christians? Or China, where they're oppressing even Muslims? All these things that we call human rights violations. Where do human rights come from? Do they come out of thin air? See, the Christian worldview has an explicit answer to this, and it goes like this. In the beginning, God. I don't get to say what's right and wrong. I don't get to determine what values you should have and what values I should have. Why? Because God has already spoken. You see, the seedbed for the bloodbath that became the 20th century grew in the heart and mind of a man named Friedrich Nietzsche. Anyone ever read any of his writings? He didn't say it on one occasion. He said it on many occasions. God is dead. God remains dead. And we've killed him. And he intended that to be a good thing. He wanted us to move beyond our religious superstitions and things that are going to be on the up and up from here. He was after something that he was perfectly willing to accept, and it's this. He understood that the removal of the foundational piece, in the beginning God, would create there would be an inevitable replacement, and he wanted that replacement to be survival of the fittest, because he wanted everything on top just to turn to chaos. He was actually one of the few brave enough atheists to live his life consistent with that type of worldview. He'd be like, I'm perfectly okay with that kind of chaotic result. It's not surprising that at the end of his life, he really literally went insane. Another famous atheist named Bertrand Russell had this very vulnerable moment when he wrote this about himself. The center of me is always and eternally in terrific pain, or terrible pain. A searching for something beyond what the world contains, something transfiguring and infinite. He had a very perceptive daughter who would later write about him. Somewhere at the back of my father's mind, at the bottom of his heart, in the depth of his soul, there's an empty space that had once been filled by God, and he never found anything else to put in it. For most people, this is not attractive. Most people would say, I don't want to live like there's no God. I don't want to live without beauty and truth and goodness. So what they'll do is they'll borrow instead. They don't want to live in chaos, but there's a whole lot of people that don't want to live under the worship of one true God either. So what they'll often do is kind of skim off the top and choose pieces of those ancient truths and try to build their own structures on top of them. So we'll borrow something like goodness. And we'll replace, in the beginning, God with our own versions of goodness. And we try to create our own moral framework that says something like this. Let's just all be good people. But it's not big enough to support that structure. It will crumble. Others will take something like, and we haven't even talked about this yet, but they'll take something like government, and they'll replace, in the beginning, God with government. This is historically true and happened over and over and over again. One commentator said this: in the ancient world, the state didn't just act like a god, they believed it was a manifestation of God. The state provided the connecting point between heaven and earth, and the ruler was not just a representative of a god, but most often he claimed divine attributes or even deity itself. In the pagan mind, the world is largely chaos, and the state provides a visible means of curtailing loose ends. It provides security in a wild world, and the modern welfare state makes the same promises. Now, of course, that's what those ancient pagans would do, right? We're far more sophisticated. We would never look to the government to provide for us what only God can provide, right? We would never expect the government to be the ultimate provider of our or our ultimate protector. Of course we would. And it's still called, like it was 2,000 years ago, idolatry. It's idolatry of the human heart. And here's the thing about idolatry. When we worship false gods, and those false gods don't deliver the goods, we get mad. We get really angry. So, for example, when the government can't seem to cure COVID, we get upset. When the government can't supply me a high salary just for showing up to work, when the government can't take away all of my college debt, when the government can't relieve all of my prior bad decisions, give me all of my wants and all of my desires simply because I'm human, I get angry. But most often what we do is we replace in the beginning God with the thing that Nietzsche said we would. He said, must we ourselves not become gods? He knew this is where it would take us. It's the very first temptation, isn't it? And the very first sin. The devil told Eve, you can be like God. So we replaced in the beginning God with me. And what you might notice is that me, I, probably you, we're nowhere near big enough to hold up that structure. It will all come tumbling down. Last year, the Detroit Tigers were the best team in baseball heading into the All-Star break. And while other teams took advantage of that trading season to bolster their team, become better teams, maybe to stay in contention or for some even get into contention, Tigers didn't do much of anything. Right after the trade line, they slumped and they slumped badly. They limped into playoffs. And they won a couple of games, but the lack of a good trade made all of the difference. In my opinion, just me speaking here, after watching the 2025 playoffs and World Series, had they just added one good bet to their lineup, they'd probably be the 2025 World Series champions. Simply put, their trades or lack of trades last year were pathetic. You want to hear an even worse trade? The worst trade ever made is the trade that's been made over and over and over again every single day. It's the trade that Adam and Eve made when they looked at their creator and said, we don't want to live under your rule anymore. We want to rule ourselves. We want to be in charge. We want to reign. It's the same trade you and I make when we decide we want to worship something created instead of the creator. It's the Old Testament book of Samuel all over again. It's one of the most pathetic moments in history when the prophet Samuel is now getting very old. And up to that point, Israel had had no king. No human king, at least. God was their king. They had judges and prophets and leaders, but the public opinion poll began to turn against God a little bit here. And so they went to Samuel and they said, Samuel, we want a human king. We want a king who can lead us into battle. We want a king whose names we can put on yard signs and on bumper stickers. We want a king who will represent our nation. Here's the way it reads in Scripture. They went to Samuel and said, now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have. But when they said, give us a king to lead us, this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said, listen to all that the people are saying to you. It is not you they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king. as they have done from the since the day I brought them out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you. Now listen to them, but warn them solemnly, and let them know what the king who will reign over them will claim as his rights. And so before I read this next part, I want you to pay really careful attention here to everything this human king is going to spend his time doing to the people he's supposed to lead, to the people he's supposed to serve. Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king, and he said, "This is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they will run in front of his chariots. Some he'll assign as commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties. Others he'll assign to plow his ground and reap his harvest. Still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants. Your male and female servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys, he will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. And when that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, but the Lord will not answer you in that day." Does the word take stand out at all? And this is exactly what happens when we build our lives on anyone or anything other than the one true God. False gods only consume. They can only take and take and take until you have nothing left to give, including the ones we love most when we lay them on the altar, whatever it is that we've made central and foundational to our lives. They just take it all. And what's sad is, even with these words of warning, the people didn't listen to Samuel. The text continues, but the people refused to listen. "No," they said, "we want a king over us. Then we'll be like all the other nations with a king to lead us and go up before us and fight our battles." When Samuel heard that all the people said, he repeated it before the Lord. The Lord answered, "Listen to them and give them a king." And they got exactly what they asked for. They made a terrible trade. But it wasn't the first time. It certainly would not be the last time. This is the fundamental and tragic story of the human heart. Romans describes it this way. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie. They worshiped and served created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. There's no one or no thing in your life who can hold up under the pressure of your worship. You and I cannot help but give our worship up and devotion to someone or something because we're designed, we're created, we're built to worship. And when we give our worship to the one true God, here's the cool thing. Everything else in life that we care so much about, it will fall into place and will rest comfortably on the beauty of that foundation. And with God's help, we can enjoy a beautiful life. And it will hold up. Now, I have no idea what 2026 is going to hold for us. I really don't. But I know this. Our God reigns. And I can promise you this. God is not in heaven wringing his hands. He's not seated on the throne watching CNN or Fox News. He's not scrolling to the left of his iPhone, overwhelmed with anxiety and worry. I can promise you that Psalm 47:8 is as true today as it was the day it was written. God reigns over the nations. God sits on his holy throne. The question for us today is this. What about you? What about your heart? What about your mind? What about your body? What about your soul? Does God reign in you? God reigns over this world, whether we want him to or not. God has reigned, he is reigning, and he will reign, but he will not force himself on you. does God reign in you?